This evening we are welcoming Alexis Simondinger, who has graciously appeared at all of the sessions that we have had each year of the course, and has talked about reporting from the White House from several different angles. Alexis has been with National Journal. She is the White House correspondent, the senior White House correspondent for National Journal. When did you start working at National Journal?
In 1997.
And before that, she worked with the Bureau of National Affairs and was doing economic reporting as well as political from the vantage point of the White House. That is particularly important because what it does, having a knowledge of a particular area, policy area, provides one with a thread to look at the White House, to see how things operate, to see who is involved in policy, not just who people say is involved, but who's really involved. So it provides one with a particularly good perspective. And Alexis, tell us something about how you got to the White House and what kind of background you had. What did you major in college, for example, and where did you go to college?
I went to a really small college called New College, which is in Sarasota, Florida. And I grew up in Washington, D.C. I'm the daughter of a journalist. So I knew I was interested in journalism, but I wanted to go to college to learn how to think and then go to graduate school, which I did, and got a journalism degree at the University of Missouri. And then worked for a while in reporting positions in newspapers in Florida. And then after 3 years came back to Washington, D.C. because that's where I knew I wanted to do reporting and tried to get into the policy arena, start covering Washington from the policy vantage point. And I did various executive departments, and then I did Congress. And one thing leads to another, and Congress helps you really intersect a lot with the White House, no matter whose administration it is. And then I started covering the White House when President Bush Sr. was campaigning in hoping to get another second term, which he did not do, and that was because Bill Clinton beat him. And then I continued to cover Clinton for eight years and have now done a Republican president into his second term, which makes it interesting. And I should tell the students that it is not common for correspondents to cover the White House for a long period of time these days. But one thing that National Journal allows us to do, because it's nonpartisan, it's a weekly, is that we don't do all the travel that some of my colleagues do, and we can stand back and do what we call enterprise reporting. So it's a high stamina thing for many of the other journalists that you have come and speak to your class who would no more think about covering the White House for two administrations than the man in the moon, because they want to migrate to do something else. But you can do it at National Journal because we cover the White House in a different way.
Uh-huh. That leads to a couple of questions there. One is, what is traveling like with the president?
Well, traveling with
why does it eat you up?
It eats you up because it's very wearing. Modern presidents these days want to take their message out, which is something you've written a lot about. They travel ferociously, and correspondents have to deal with the schedule and the kinds of events that the president does. It's also very expensive to travel, so news organizations have to make commitments to have multiple people, usually, or whole crews of people to do a presidential trip. And it involves a lot of trying to work on deadlines in another time zone oftentimes, or you're trying to cover the president's event of that day in a way that the president is trying to hand feed you the information. So it's a kind of a thankless, not always creative kind of endless series of travel. And so a lot of our colleagues in the White House press corps like that kind of work sometimes least of all, and like to do more creative enterprise reporting when they can. It's harder and harder to do.
Uh-huh. In with National Journal, you cover more than what a lot of people cover at the White House. A lot of people are focused on the president himself and kind of body coverage.
Right.
What has the president done? What has the president said? And you are interested in the institution of the presidency as well as what happens in the White House generally.
Right. And I think people don't really understand that there is a president, but there's also the presidency, the institution itself. And then One of the things that I found really interesting as a reporter is to try to cover all the underpinnings that give the president the wherewithal to do what he does, or to claim that he has the wherewithal to do what he does. And that's everything from the apparatus that allows him to function as president to, of course, the constitutional underpinnings, to the entire executive branch, to the interaction with the legislative branch. I'm interested in things that have to do with the budget or the career people who work for the president, the kinds of continuity in governance, the sorts of things that we talked about after 9/11, for instance, in terms of how does a government function even if one particular individual, the president, is harmed in some way or cannot function in some way. So all of those things help, I think, inform our understanding of democracy as we know it, and of course also it informs my understanding of the person, the personality who is the president.
Often the information that you're seeking is information that the White House may not want to provide. So they will give you some information. You know, some information comes out on the record. But what kinds of mixture do you have of sources of information in a story?
Well, one of the things that I learned when I covered Congress was that you can really do a good job trying to cover one element or two elements of policy or presidential decision-making if you have sources on Capitol Hill. In the case of a president like Bush, who had Republican majorities, if you interact with sources that you know in the Republican Party on the Hill, for instance, you can oftentimes better inform yourself of what, about what the president is thinking. I think you, it's probably hard to magnify the extent to which it's difficult to cover this administration if all you had to depend on was this president and his aides in terms of covering the White House. And I think we've talked in the past about, I have a colleague, we know someone who works for Fox News, who said he would be fired if all he depended on was the Bush administration and the Bush aides to help him do his reporting of the White House. And that's Fox, which is a network considered to be very friendly to the administration. So you have to use Congress, lobbyists, for instance, the constituency groups who are very supportive of the president's policies can help you a lot. Also, the apparatus that is the Republican Party or the party of the president can be very helpful. All the people who surround the Republican National Committee or the support structure for the Republican Party can sometimes be very helpful to frame out a story. If you follow the executive branch, if you try to go out into the departments themselves, sometimes in the past that has been more productive than it is with this administration because they have such a stranglehold on the political people who run the executive departments, and they're all trained to report back to the West Wing what kind of media inquiries they're getting, what stories are brewing. They're not allowed to be independent actors in the way, for instance, when I covered the Clinton administration, it was a Katie bar the door free-for-all in terms of being able to get stories out of the executive branch. Less disciplined, and the kinds of things that this administration has done to really control information were not even thought of in the Clinton administration.
What are some of the things that they're doing that previous administrations haven't done or haven't done to the same extent?
Well, one of the things that this administration did from the get-go was try to install in the departments themselves some of their own people handpicked from the West Wing to really help manage the president's agenda and work back to the West Wing on whether it's the legal issues, the legislative affairs issues, the media press issues, certainly any public liaison issues, in other words, dealing with the constituency groups, all of that controlled out of the West Wing. Now, the Clinton administration certainly wanted to drive policy out of the West Wing and control their message, but they also had put in place a lot of cabinet officials and various administration officials who own their own turf and could make decisions independently and help guide the West Wing about what the president's policy should be or could be to be to his advantage. The other thing this administration has dreamed up that I never thought I would see is that if they couldn't control what I and the media were doing, they would actually get surrogates dreamed up out of their Republican world to become like surrogate reporters. So, for instance, they let contracts out at executive departments to produce what they called, this is just a few examples, virtual videos. They were supposed to be, they were supposed to look like real news stories. HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, did this to try to sell Medicare. They looked like they were real news stories, but they were actually paid advertisements for the president's policy that they sent out to local television stations, who used the videos as if they were real news stories and did not advertise that they were created by the Bush administration. Or they paid journalists in Iraq, for instance, to put friendly news stories that the Department of Defense created into Iraqi media in order to support the president's policies in Iraq at the very beginning of the occupation. And those are the kinds of things that however clever or slick we might have thought of the Clinton administration, that would have been something the Clintons didn't think they could get away with. So however tempted they might have been to try to be that controlling, they didn't actually attempt in that kind of concerted way.
One of the things that that we've discussed from the Libby trial, and that's the trial of Louis Scooter Libby, who was chief of staff to Vice President Cheney, and I guess the did the jury get the case today? If they wound
they've
up?
Been hearing the arguments.
That in that case that involved all the different kinds of things that were done to try to deal with the Joseph Wilson op-ed piece in the New York Times and to discredit what he had to say, and in large part through through attacks on his wife and that sort of thing. But one of the things that comes out of that is that there are a great deal of time of a lot of people who were very senior at the White House were involved in it, and that in the end it really wasn't successful.
Right. One of the things that fascinates me is the extent to which administrations, particularly what I cover, the White House, will go to shape a message, to control a message, to promote a particular message, either on a positive side, in other words, here's what the president is promoting, or on a defensive side, which is, here's an enemy of the president, here's why this person should not be believed. The extent to which they do that, thinking that there's some avenue or corner that they need to turn in order to insert the information rather than coming straight out and saying, here's what I believe and here's why. In the case of Scooter Libby, what came to me so clearly and to others in the White House press corps is that now that we've peeled the onion layers back and we've seen through the actual documents that were acquired by subpoena in that case, we've seen the vice president's handwritten notes, we've seen memos by his communications and press office. We've seen the chief of staff's notes to himself or notes between he and the vice president about what they needed to do. There was a moment there where they could have just come forward publicly and said, Joseph Wilson, former ambassador, is not credible on this issue and here's why. Or he's tainted to some extent with a certain world point of view because he's a Democrat, he supports John Kerry, and his wife worked at the CIA and helped send him on this trip, this fact-finding trip, or just simply what worried the vice president, which was that people thought he had sent Joe Wilson. If he had just come forward and said, none of these things are true, and here's why, and here's what we believe, they could have saved themselves all this agony and trouble. Instead, what they were doing was trying to insert their view that Joe Wilson was tainted because his wife had sent him on a junket, that's the word the vice president used, and they did it through so many avenues to try to work it into the mainstream media, whether it was NBC, through several avenues, through NBC, or Time magazine, or in the case of Judy Miller, the New York Times at that point. And what we found out is that various people were acting independently. For instance, Richard Armitage, who was the deputy secretary at State, who was not necessarily coordinating with what Scooter Libby was doing, was also offering the information up to Robert Novak and to Bob Woodward at an early juncture. And instead, they should have just tried to figure out a way to, if they felt so strongly that the public should know about this, just come out and state it. And it backfired on them for a number of reasons. One is they found reporters didn't care who sent Joe Wilson.
Uh-huh.
Horrors.
Uh-huh.
They just didn't care. Some of them just didn't do stories about it. Or the real backfire was that reporters sniffed that there was a potential smear, which is what happened at Time magazine, when two reporters, one on an Africa trip and one in Washington, collaborated with their information and said, this isn't a legitimate objection. This seems like this is trying to hurt this guy.
Yeah.
And then all of those things promoted and provoked, sparked lots of conspiracy theories about what was going on, and that prompted a Justice Department investigation, which then prompted calls for a special prosecutor, and then, as Bill Clinton learned with special prosecutors, you can't control it anymore, and then it's, you know, totally out of the barn.
Uh-huh. Why do you think they chose that route? Why not just come out and, you know, come out into the briefing room, you know, have maybe have Steve Hadley talk about it, the national security person, or have somebody on the vice president's staff talk directly?
Well, to me, this would be my theory. There are a couple of reasons why that might have happened. One is that the people who seemed to care the most were in the vice president's office. And as we know with Vice President Cheney's operations, he tends to be a very independent actor, not necessarily a person you call on and think of as, although he's very much a team player, he's not always coordinating with what the West Wing was doing. So there may have been a concern on their part that however much they protested, and we saw that Vice President Cheney was trying to tell poor Scott McClellan, who was then the press secretary, to get it together to start to defend his chief of staff, he wanted to drive the West Wing's communication operation, which was hard for him to do. They may have felt like they needed to act independently because the West Wing was not going to approve of a go public kind of a an effort. And then the other element is that this is an administration that actually loves secrecy. They covet the control that they can try to exert. They have a track record of trying to use the mainstream media in various ways to promote a message or communications because to them it's more controllable. And I think it's hard for administrations to change the techniques that they draw on and think of as successful until they're unsuccessful. And in this case, this was just incredibly unsuccessful.
Uh-huh. Do you think that it, when you begin getting to the point of understanding that it's unsuccessful, is it that they have to get to a point where the president himself understands that these efforts are unsuccessful and that really only at that point can you do it where the president recognizes that things aren't working and that he wants something? Or does it depend on the administration?
It depends a little bit on the administration and the personality of the president. But I think the point that you're making, which is a really good one, which is who's driving the president's communication strategy. In the case of President Bush, my belief is that he drives his strategy. Mm-hmm. He's the person who has a very strong idea about how his press and communications operations should function. And Lord knows Vice President Cheney has a very strong idea himself. So, and that would be to not communicate as much as he can. In this case, one of the examples that I think really brings to the fore President Bush's own stubbornness about his communication strategy is Katrina. There is no better example in my mind of a president who was slow, horribly slow, tragically slow, to the point of costing people their lives because he didn't understand the extent to which he needed to embrace a problem, that he needed to tackle it, he needed to get involved in it, he needed to take control of it, not just communicate about it. I'm talking about resolve the problems.
Yeah.
And that was because the president, his personality is, I'm a decider, but I'm also a delegator, and this is why I have these departments. This is what their job is, and I'm sure they're doing their jobs. This is not necessarily what I need to be worried about. And as we all know, there was an anecdote about how the president's counselor, Dan Bartlett, had to actually force the president, this was a form of persuasion of a president, to force him to come to grips with the failures, because we remember President Bush refused to admit that things were not working well, even though people were dying and we could all see it on television. Dan Barlow put together some video clips of what was happening, what was being covered by television, to force the president to look at the pictures and see that things were not going that great. And remember, you know, we'd already had the president with Michael Brown of the Federal Emergency Management Agency saying, "You're doing a heck of a job, Brownie." I mean, this was a tragedy of policy and management proportions that also became a horror of communications proportions.
When Katrina was coming, he was on vacation, and
he was on his way. Yes.
Well, he was
on a trip, coming back.
He had been in Crawford during the month of August.
Yes.
And then he had a plan for what he was going to do. He was going to New Mexico. He had a couple of speeches. He might have had one in Arizona, I think, healthcare, and then he was going to San Diego for a speech on Iraq. And he is a person who plans things out and likes to stick to the plan.
Yes, but for a strategic reason. It's not just his personality, where he's very disciplined, and we know he is very disciplined in his personal habits. To some extent, you could talk about, you know, his background, how he grew up, somebody who had kicked a drinking problem and is a, you know, vigorous exerciser, all these things about his personality. But strategically, the president thinks that if you are on offense as a president, it's because you are adhering to your game plan.
Right.
What are my issues? What are my policies? I'm promoting that. When you are responding to external events or your critics or what's happening in Congress to some extent, then you're on defense. And President Bush believed for a long period of time, and I think he still fundamentally believes this, although he's adapted more, is that when you're playing defense, you're losing. And what he failed, I think, to understand is that, and slowly he understood this, that you have no choice as president. You have to play defense way more than you'd ever like to. And if you took a lesson from President Clinton's 8 years, you learn that sometimes the best opportunities you're handed as president are because you're exploiting opportunities to play defense, either against your enemies or against external events. Oklahoma City, for example, President Clinton rebuilt his presidency at a time he needed to by being the what they call the comforter-in-chief after the Oklahoma City bombing. So you can exploit what looks at first to be weak openings or tragedies to some extent, and I don't mean that in a callous way, but you can show yourself as a person who can govern by taking advantage of those things. And President Bush has just been very slow to realize that.
And his operation.
And his operation, absolutely.
That.
And part of that comes from campaigning. I think that's something that's really built in, not just to President Bush as the son of a president, because he feels like he took a lot of lessons from his dad, who, after all, only got one term, but also because he was a successful person, President Bush, campaigning. He was a very successful Texas governor. He beat Ann Richards, a very successful Democratic opponent. He exploited opportunities there. But he just likes as an individual and as a political figure to adhere to his own plan. And that's something that campaigns have the luxury of doing, and you don't have the luxury of doing that as president.
Do you think that they've learned that their communications operation reflects learning, particularly in the second term?
Well,
what are the differences?
Yeah, I think I would say yes. One of the things that I notice is that the president has done something much more in the second term than he ever did in the first. And you and I have talked about this before, is he has said, "I made mistakes. This was a mistake." He's fessed up, and he seemed to become reluctantly more comfortable at saying, "I'm going to change my tactics or my strategy because this didn't work." He doesn't look like he loves it, but he does it much faster now. And he learned that he needed to do that because, as president, his job approval ratings, his support in the country is down, hovering near Nixon territory. And it is very difficult to govern if you are always going against the majority of public sentiment. And the president realizes that with the Iraq War and other elements of his presidency, it's been difficult. So he's faster to change, to pivot. The other thing is he has a different chief of staff now. He has a more pragmatic person in Joshua Bolton, who is a little bit more successful at knocking the president's hard head and that of the staff and saying this is what we're going to do, or we need to be a little bit more improvisational. Mm-hmm. We need to wait and see what the tea leaves are going to bring, and then we're going to try to respond accordingly. He's not averse to reaching out to members of Congress and talking strategically about ways that they can modify the president's path that's already been carved out. And the first term, Andy Card as the chief of staff, a very nice person. Everybody in the White House liked working for Andy. But he was more a person, and you've written about this, Martha, is that White Houses tend to reflect the weaknesses of a president, not fill those gaps with people who have stronger ways to sort of knock a president's head. And Andy was somebody who magnified the president's weaknesses in some ways by going along with the direction he wanted to go in, mm-hmm. as opposed to combating the president and saying, no, you know, mm-hmm. no, we need to do this, we need to do that. And Josh Bolton is more successful, and that's partially because the president realized that he may have won re-election, which to him was the zenith of success. That was it for him. Fabulous. We all remember how he said, I have a mandate now. You know, people, if you're with me, you know, I'm going to be with you, that kind of thing. And then that lasted about 20 minutes until he realized that, yes, he was reelected, but he was supposed to represent, the American public thought, represent their perspective, not necessarily they weren't applauding everything that the president was saying were his policies.
One of the campaigns that you followed in this administration was the campaign to reform Social Security and to develop personal retirement.
Yeah, that was
accounts.
Really successful, wasn't it?
And can you tell us something about both the campaign itself, because that was done in the second term at a time when he had political capital. He said that he really had political capital coming off of his re-election victory. And then how did you report it? How did you get information on it?
Well, let me start with the information, first of all. Because this was a little easier, because the president was unilaterally, of his own decision-making, deciding that all of 2005 was going to be devoted to reforming Social Security. And that, in his mind, meant getting Congress to adopt and embrace what he called personal investment accounts. He and the administration were more disposed to work with reporters to report that story. So there was something the president was promoting, and we had a better time getting access to the information. Uh-huh. But what we found right away was at the very first get-go, when the administration was unveiling its proposal of how personal investment accounts would work, they put out a policy person named Chuck Blauhaus, who was there to try to help the press corps understand how this all would work. And it was such a Rube Goldberg sort of a system of explaining how this would work and who the winners and who the losers would be and where they would get the money, which they never really said. Okay, it would cost $1 trillion to transition from the existing system to the new system. That right away, with all those reporter questions, you could see that this was not entirely gelled and thought through. This had a certain laboratory quality where it was perfect in the lab and, you know, it was not going to be so great on the street.
Yeah.
And then the other thing the administration didn't recognize for some odd reason was that they were going to treat the president's Social Security like it was a political campaign, but they didn't imagine that other people were going to treat protecting Social Security in much the same way, so that there were constituency groups out there like the American Association for the Retired People that were going to be very defensive on behalf of seniors for the existing system. And then in addition, the American public was going to be difficult to persuade because it is the most popular government program that we have had since FDR invented it, and that senior people, the folks who benefit from Social Security, are what? The most active, persistent, and regular voters, and they pay a lot of attention. So right there, the president had some built-in challenges to his mandate to lead America towards a reform. And in the end, what happened after 2005 was two things. One was the White House was able to persuade the public that Social Security is a fiscal problem, a challenge, meaning that we have too many people who are benefiting from Social Security and not enough workers paying into the system, and that we're going to have a problem. But then the other thing was, the more the president talked about his ideas, less Americans liked it. So by the end of 2005, he had actually talked America out of his ideas. Mm-hmm. So he had laid the groundwork for the defenders of Social Security much more strongly to triumph politically over their defense of the system. And the president had weakened his own credibility with the electorate going into a re-election year for Republicans, not his own, but for Republicans in 2006. Now, with Iraq and all of the scandals in Congress, we would say Republicans lost their majorities for those reasons, but Social Security did not help. And you notice that when we listen to the State of the Union address here today, this year, 2007, in January, we did not hear the president talk too much about Social Security. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is an issue that the president reluctantly had to accept is gone for his two terms. So he made an effort, talked America out of it, and he will leave having made a stronger case for Democrats than when he started.
Immigration was the other issue that that he had talked about, and that too has proved to be a nettlesome one. One of the things that White Houses don't talk about, but is an important aspect of the news media, is the learning that takes place from the things that reporters write.
Yes.
That the news media is a valuable institution for democracy because it lets citizens know what things are really happening in government, what things perhaps the government officials don't want to release or government officials simply don't know. And we've had a very good case of that over this past weekend in a series of articles that came out in the Washington Post. And can you tell us something about that?
Let me ask the class, can I see hands? How many people read any of the stories about Walter Reed? Did anybody read them in the Washington Post? How many hands are up? It's hard to see. One? Two?
Yeah, just a couple.
Okay. Well, if you get a chance, go online when we're finished talking, and there were two stories over the weekend, and take a look at the stories, because they're good examples of how a president never appreciates learning bad things about his executive branch from a major American newspaper, especially at a time when the president is trying to show that he is incredibly supportive of the troops, and that Democrats might be interested in undercutting the interests of the troops if they try to challenge the funding for the war. So go back and look at these stories, because you're going to see this race to reform Walter Reed. Basically, the stories try to describe the conditions for outpatient services at Walter Reed, which is a Department of the Army facility in Washington that has, since the Eisenhower years, treated American military. And Walter Reed happens to be, the hospital itself, not the outpatient services, happens to be an excellent medical facility for things like amputations and artificial limbs. I mean, it's the best in the country. Organ transplants, they really have a terrific group of people at the hospital. This is where the president has visited and delivered Purple Hearts to these really amazing veterans who have lost limbs and their quality of life and everything else there. Really tragic stories, but very, I would say, inspirational too. But many of them actually get discharged from the hospital and then have a kind of a halfway treatment period of time in which they're at the outpatient services, which are plagued with things like moldy facilities and not very good sanitation, exactly. And also, some of the veterans are complaining that the military are too quick to claim that their conditions as outpatients were pre-existing conditions, as opposed to conditions that happened to them as a result of the war. So at any rate, in exhausting detail with color pictures, horrible stories, and the president learned about this from the newspapers. So what has happened today is that the reporters...
Because today's the first day
today
since
Today is the first day since President's Day to get the White House to react. So reporters in the press corps, the White House press corps, go to the president's spokesperson, who's Tony Snow, and spent today asking, what did the president know about this? What was his reaction to this? Because all of us know the president has gone to Walter Reed a lot to commiserate with the veterans and to show his support for them. And in this case, the White House did a kind of an awkward job of trying to refer all the detailed questions about this to the Department of the Army at DOD, which is in fact responsible for Walter Reed. And then Tony Snow was very slow to be able to say, absolutely, at the beginning, the president was appalled, he read these stories, he had absolutely no idea, he picked up the phone. Whatever story he could have told about the president's reaction, he just didn't quite come up with. And so by the end of the briefing, this still had not been stated, and the transcript of the press secretary's briefing gets distributed this mm-hmm. afternoon. And there's an asterisk at the bottom of it, which corrects the record, or as we would say, revises and extends uh-huh. the record to say that the president is not accepting of these conditions and, you know, had this reaction and wants this fixed and, you know, all these things that it had to say. Uh-huh. So this was an example, again, of a little bit slow on the uptake, even though today the Department of the Army had briefings for reporters to describe that the Department of Defense was appalled. Also, the Secretary of the Army said he had no idea. Now, keep in mind, there's a new Secretary of the Army, so you can imagine he can say
right.
all the things he wants because he's brand new.
Yeah.
So this was a situation in which a 1 or 2 day story cycle is now going to be a very extended news cycle coverage of this.
Yeah, because one of the first things people want to know is that personal reaction of the president.
Right.
Because they've seen the pictures of him at Walter Reed
right.
With the veterans.
And every veteran would want to know this, and every reporter
yeah.
in the room was asking the questions because of the human interest elements, but also the political elements of this, because the president is about to get in March into a fight with Democrats over funding, continued supplemental funding
uh-huh.
for the Iraq war, and Democrats, of course, are trying to apply conditions or would like to, some of them, and mm-hmm. the president is trying to say to them, you don't care about the troops. You're trying to undercut the interests of the troops. So the political ramifications of this put the president in an awkward situation.
Mm-hmm.
If he looks like he's talking up money for fighting a war, but he's not taking care of
right.
the casualties of the war.
Uh-huh. What are some other articles that you can think of that we as citizens have learned about governmental operations through the news media? Articles where we learned how government operated in a way that the government officials weren't telling us.
Oh, well, how about Watergate?
Uh-huh.
You're talking about in my experience.
Sure.
I'm not that old. I did not cover Watergate. But I was a kid when Watergate happened, and of course we all remember that what we learned out of reporting, and also because of the congressional interest in subpoena power to bring officials
right.
to reckoning,
uh-huh.
was that President Nixon had taped himself, and because of the president's tapes, we learned a great deal about governing inside the White House, way, way more than any supporter of President Nixon
uh-huh.
Felt that they had even known. Even in some of
right.
the president's aides inside the White House were shocked and awed, as we would say, about President Nixon's
uh-huh.
language. President Nixon had not only a very colorful use of language in private, but he also had some very ugly things to say about Jews. He loved to sit around and, you know, shred his enemies in discussion.
Yeah.
He had a very dark side that came forward in the tapes. And, of
yeah.
course, all of the operations that came to be known as Watergate. Watergate was sort of a a bundle of things that the administration was doing to support the president in a re-election effort. But abuses of power, you know, using the executive branch to illegal ends, all of those kinds of things, we learned a lot about. In President Clinton's, in the time that I covered President Clinton, we learned some things about the White House operations that we had not known. And I mean that in this, not just the Monica Lewinsky sense, which, of course, was an interesting cycle of stories, but also even things like the president's fundraising, the efforts for the president's fundraising for his reelection, when he was called to task by Republicans in Congress to come clean, and there were special investigations both on the Hill and by independent investigators from the Justice Department, assigned from the Justice Department, to explore the president's fundraising and whether they were legal, et cetera. So President Clinton went through a rough patch of investigations, which revealed a lot about how the White House operations worked. And not just through reporting, reporters broke a lot of stories, but also I want to just say, reporters don't have subpoena power. So what ends up happening in the cycle of communication is that if reporters either originate a story or respond to investigations, that there can be multiple checks on a president, both the ones that are provided in the Constitution, but also the one provided by the public and the electorate, which is, you know, we in the Fourth Estate in the media are the surrogates for the public. So when they work hand in hand, you learn a lot about how a president operates.
Right. And in a way, that in a congressional hearing, Congress doesn't want to tackle subjects where they don't have a sense of what's going on. They don't want a lot of dry holes. And with news media, the news media has traditionally been more willing to try to investigate a variety of things and has been a little more willing to do that. And so they have dug up stuff, and then at a certain point, then the Congress will take it over.
Well, and oftentimes the media and the not so much the media and the courts, but the media and Congress will often work hand in hand on stories because they can be mutually supportive of one another. The media may not advocate for a certain outcome the way members of Congress might, but the media, by nature, are advocating for a certain level of transparency. And so Congress can use the media to leak information or provide information or to grab the information that's being dug up by reporters. But there's oftentimes a communion of enterprise in a long investigation where you'll see that a good newspaper will start to say that so-and-so investigative committee will be reporting, you know, this week that blah, 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 blah. And that's because they have sources on the committee highlighting what is to come to build a threshold of stories that will keep the pressure on and keep, and that's in the interest of the media, because the media are very interested in providing a kind of exposure of news or a transparency of governing, rather than necessarily advocating for a certain outcome.
Yeah. Well, an example that just struck me as you were talking is the series of articles, some that were in National Journal and then some in the Washington Post, about Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist, and his misuse of funds and all of the people that got swept up into that, who were members of Congress and also who were staff people.
Yes,
that
exactly.
In a way, that came from the Hill.
Yes.
There were staff people that were giving information to the Post and to others. And then gradually, when those articles came out, then you had Justice Department investigations, and you know, ultimately you have trials,
indictments, trials,
convictions,
and they're serving time in prison.
Yeah,
exactly.
Can you tell us something about the changes in the media, the types of media that we have, and what that does as far as the information we're provided from the time when you first started reporting? You know, start back in St. Petersburg. and the kind of media there are, and then what we have today. And are we better off today than we once were?
Well, let me see another show of hands. How many people read in this class read a newspaper every single day? Ooh, you're an aberration. That's a lot of hands. How many people watch? Oh, now, let me ask you, how many people read your newspaper online? Okay, so you guys feel comfortable reading newspapers electronically as opposed to a paper-based newspaper, right? Yeah. How many people get news from television every day? So that's a lot of hands, too. Okay. How many people get your news from John Stewart? Yay! Thank God. How many people get your news from blogs? Thank God. You're not just doing this to impress me, right?
Okay. What about Google? Getting Google News or Yahoo News?
And what she's talking about is, do you program, you know, Google to send you stuff you're interested in? You set it up so that you can get regular emails?
Or do you just go on there?
Or do you go on to search for the wire services or something like that?
No.
Okay. Well, when I, in the third Metazoa era, when I first started reporting, there was, you know, network television, there were no cable, and it was print, you know, newspapers. That's what I thought I would spend my career doing, is newspapers. And I grew up in a period of time when there were still evening newspapers when I was a little kid, and the whole economy of American workers was geared towards maybe you would have two newspapers a day, at least in many towns. And then I went into journalism school during a period of time in which there was a contraction of the number of American newspapers. And then in the 1980s, cable CNN was born, and cable news, 24-hour news, became an innovation that changed the nature a lot of the way I saw President Clinton's administration, which was the first to really take advantage of that, not the first to deal with cable news, but the first to try to take advantage of it. And then President Clinton's administration was the first to really deal with the internet as a communication tool. And that was a whole new innovation for news reporters. And we didn't anticipate that it would be an avenue to actually publish information. We thought of it more as a tool to research, that you would be able to research. No one had the idea at the beginning just how ubiquitous it would be to everything that we think about in terms of moving data. So all of those things have offered reporters many more opportunities to cover presidents and to cover the White House, and offered presidents many more opportunities to try to shape their message. And so much more specialized news publications now, niche publications, and I mean that both electronically and print. And so we noticed, for instance, in President Bush's effort to be reelected, that he understood that he could do very targeted things to reach audiences by using talk radio, or to give interviews to Golf Digest, or to appear at NASCAR events. You know, the presidents have many more opportunities to hit their target audiences, and I'm talking about real micro audiences, to try to send a message. So when I was first a reporter, it was common to think of presidents trying to go over the heads of the mainstream media to try to talk to local media. But there was still a recognition in the White House at the time that I was beginning to cover the White House that you still had to deal with the majors. You still really had to sell your message to the networks or the big TV or the big mainstream newspapers. In the time I've been a reporter, there was a new national newspaper added, USA Today, and people thought that was going to be a fly-by-night. That thing wouldn't last. But it became very, very popular, and it's been very successful. Both President Clinton and President Bush have taken advantage of that. So the challenge it's presented for a reporter like me, now keep in mind, I write for a magazine, a weekly magazine, that the White House thinks of as kind of a niche publication, because our audience is what we think of as, quote-unquote, the opinion elites, meaning people who have enough money which is a considerable amount of money to subscribe, and also need that level, that depth of reporting beyond what they get in the newspapers to do their jobs. So we have a lot of lobbyists and lawyers and business people who, Congress, mm-hmm. who get our magazine. So the president has lots of ways to choose to sell his message, and I have a lot more competition in trying to get my mm-hmm. information, trying to get an interview, trying to get administration officials to talk to us so they can cherry pick what they think will be useful. And that's usually the guidance. The White House is much more interested in what's going to help President Bush than what I'm interested in or what will help me with my story. Just because I'm interested in doing a story about the new White House counsel doesn't mean that the White House is interested in helping me do that story because I ask. So they can be much more selective, and it's more challenging to try to do it now.
Do you have to try to provide them with a good reason? Say that, you know, in our readership, we have, you know, all of the large number of members of Congress and staff people, and they are going to be an important audience for the council.
Yes, absolutely. Because I'll give you an example from last year. President Bush has what we would think of as checkered relations with Congress. And then what happened in November is he has such checkered relations that now he's dealing with Democratic majorities, which is a real push-me-pull-you kind of a relationship. But last year, things were dicey enough, even with his own party, that I, with National Journal, went to the White House and said, you know, I noticed that you're trying to do more events, quietly do more events, to reach out to members of Congress, even have the president do social sorts of things to try to build better goodwill mm-hmm. or a warmer relations. This is a president who has not been the LBJ of the Republican Party in trying to woo, persuade, entertain members of Congress to do his bidding. So I actually had to promote, look, you know, this story is going to be seen in every office on Capitol Hill. I want to do a story that basically says the president's trying harder. He's trying. He's trying new things. He's trying to shake it up, which he was trying to do. So they agreed, okay, that's a story. They could see the benefit of that kind of story to them. Mm-hmm. And so that they were interested in trying to be helpful. Oftentimes, if I want to do a feature or a profile of someone that they're very fond of, they'll move heaven and earth to try to be somewhat helpful. In the Clinton years, though, I mean, if you were going to do a profile of somebody who worked for Bill Clinton, like his economic aide or his deputy press secretary, the Clintons had such an idea that everybody should have their day in the sun, and that's one way to say thank you mm-hmm. to administration officials for giving up their time and giving up their family time. You could practically get the president on the phone singing the praises of somebody for those sorts of stories. They uh-huh. really would be very amenable to certain kinds of stories just because it was something that the president thought was a gracious thing to do or that the press was interested in doing. They were more disposed to be responsive to the questions and uh-huh. the invitations yeah. of the media to participate. So it's tougher with this group. You have to think of like a hook. Like, for instance, until I think very recently, the Los Angeles Times had never gotten a sit-down interview with President Bush, even though the president was very personally disposed to high regard for the Los Angeles Times reporters. And that had more to do with what is in the what they thought of as the president's interests. California is not President Bush territory. Mm-hmm. And so they had to be more persuaded, why would this be in their interests? Mm-hmm. So they're a little bit more persuaded now when you have, you know, only 34% of the country thinking that, you know, the president's doing a good job. So they realize they have to work a little harder. Mm-hmm. And the president's doing off-the-record sit-downs with reporters, which is not an uncommon thing for presidents to do, but they tend to do it when they're on the ropes mm-hmm. instead of when they, you know, could have put some money in the bank, you know, back when they were riding high. So the president is doing more things to mix it up with the media. It's not that he's giving away more information or, you know, offering up more details. It's more that he's trying to build relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that just seems to occur in every administration is the effort to do that.
Yes.
That they think that whether it's communications people persuade the president, that if he spends more time with the president, if people see him in a more relaxed setting, that that will be favorable.
Right.
But the reality is that the reality, which actually Bush talked about in his press conference last week, he was saying that it didn't make a difference how good an explainer or how articulate he was in the speech. He said it's the policy.
And so he said
and that's true.
He was talking about it's the facts on the ground that
right.
the American public can see.
Yeah.
He was talking about Iraq, that no matter how often he talked to say things are getting better, if the audience is looking at Iraq and seeing nothing but death
right.
and mayhem, he understood now that his bully pulpit will only get him so far.
Yeah, and that's the limit of presidential mm-hmm. communications.
And that's the limit.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, Martha, you've reminded White House correspondents that presidents who have communications problems, I'm not sure how many presidents understand this from reading your work, but they tend to think that if they have a communication problem, it's because they get bad treatment by the media or people
right.
just don't understand. But what you pointed out is that it's not a communication problem they have, it's a political problem, or it's a policy
right.
problem. There's something fundamental in the foundation that's not going over well,
mm-hmm.
and that they need to rethink what they built the house on before they start worrying about why people aren't liking the house.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Towson for some questions. I know people have some questions. Somebody?
Yeah. 2 weeks ago, Ann Compton hinted that nothing stays off the record indefinitely. Would you agree with this statement?
Yes. Let me make sure I heard your question. You were saying Ann said that nothing stays off the record indefinitely?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, I think that's right. And my attitude would be it shouldn't stay off the record. Usually, presidents like to try to encourage journalists to hold something off the record for a period of time, but they also understand that we are naturally gossipy, talkative people who our business is to share information with you, not necessarily to keep information for ourselves. And so eventually, and sometimes it can be a very long period of time, information gets out. Sometimes it can be very, very quick. But I agree with her that it is very hard if you've shared anything with anyone in Washington for it to remain a secret forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be true with members of Congress.
That would be especially true with members of Congress. And that's why reporters love covering Capitol Hill, because you've got all the, 535 and all their staffs, and they all yak, and they love to talk. Much more freely, because they're all independent actors who are trying to support their own interests. And, with the White House, you're really dealing with one personality who controls with an iron fist, he likes to think. And so it can be slower at
mm-hmm.
the White House for things to bubble up to the surface. But it
yeah.
eventually does.
Uh-huh.
It eventually does.
And presidents get very frustrated.
Presidents get incredibly frustrated.
Yeah.
President Bush, like a lot of presidents, can't stand leaks, as you've noticed. Even though his administration selectively leaks information, but that's called a planned leak, a purposeful leak, as opposed to the inadvertent ones that he doesn't control. And I remember covering President Bush, his dad, and his father was so disturbed by a leak that came out about his budget. And you have to remember, this was when we were still dealing with faxes, not email or any electronic data like that. They numbered documents that were distributed at a meeting, secretly numbered them, and then tried to trace how a document got into the media by slight wording changes and numbering on the document to see if they could figure out who the leaker was, because President Bush ordered an investigation of the leak. Investigations of leaks very rarely produce anything. Well, anyway, at the end of the story, he found out that the leaker was his own budget director. So it wasn't exactly the story that he wanted to find out. He thought it would be some, career person who was his enemy or something, and it really was his own budget director who stayed on, Dick Darman. He wasn't fired. Nothing happened. You know, you can't stop. You just can't, as president. You just can't. And especially in second terms, which is why I always think reporters make a big mistake if they leave during a first term, because the second term always gets more fun, because presidents' power eventually ebbs and their problems mount, and the talking and the litigating on policy starts to happen outside of a president's control, and it's much more productive for a reporter to be covering the White House in a second term. Mm-hmm. Much more fun.
Mm-hmm. Another question?
What would you say to critics of the press who argue that media undermines the democratic system by spending too much time focusing on scandals and portraying public life as a game among scheming politicians?
Well, what would I say? I would say they're right and wrong. It's true that there are elements of the media who give everyone the impression that that's what we're doing. Gotcha journalism, the kind of personality-driven journalism, the maybe a gamesmanship about what public service really is and what people sacrifice to serve, that kind of thing. So I will fess up from the outset that that does happen. But what I want to say is that, as I was saying earlier, there are so many more outlets in the media now that call themselves media. And we can talk about that at some length, whether we consider media to be Comedy Central or some of the entertainment shows or bloggers or talk radio, whether the advocacy journalism that is really cropped up and lives and exists and flourishes because there's a big audience for it. There is a big audience for it. People like that combative kind of style. They like the kind of titillation of it. So unfortunately what's happened in my business is that media outlets are run by business organizations. They are not run as nonprofit public service organizations. And therefore businesses, media, follow where the market is and where the audience is and where the advertising dollars want to go. So if more audience wants to see combative, crossfire kind of, gotcha sort of programming, you're going to see more of that on television or on radio. And I'm not a big fan of it, an advocate for it, but, you know, we're all functioning in a really tight economic market for media organizations now. And it's just part of it is driven by what it is you guys do as an audience, and I mean you, meaning the public, not necessarily just you as a class.
Mm-hmm. I remember during the Monica Lewinsky scandal that somebody was asking your colleague, Carl Cannon, who was then working for the Baltimore Sun, why there was so much attention on Monica Lewinsky. And so he was pointing out that they were selling a lot more papers, for one thing. So
yes.
The idea that there isn't an audience out there that wants to read about it is wrong.
Yes,
and
right.
That certainly drove it. Do you all have a question?
Sounds like the beginning, there are a lot of things that are going on that are arcane, as we're put it, networking, stories that are going on behind the scenes. So the question is, how much is reporting being actually do? Compared to how much reporting it appears that you're doing when you're finally on television.
Can anybody hear the question? Would you like me to repeat it? The question was, when you see, or when you think about all of the things that, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, when you think about all the things that go into trying to acquire the information to do a story, how much reporting is actually happening behind the scenes to produce a television show or a news article compared to what you see or read when you finally see the finished product? Is that right? Yeah. The answer is that it depends on the medium and it depends on the deadline. In other words, if you are a news magazine like a 60 Minutes or Frontline, the length of time, the resources that you have, and the number of producers to put together a television show like that is very extensive, and you can figure out how much work goes into it. I don't know how many of you ever have gone on the PBS website to see that Frontline augments its shows by showing you the actual transcripts of the interviews. So if you ever want to take a look at the material that goes into producing a television special like a public television Frontline show, you can go on the website and see the material that they gather. So you can look at the foundation of the story. For a newspaper that may be working with a really tight deadline, what reporters may be depending on is a limited number but a very core group of senior officials who know what's going on or that they trust to know what's going on. And that's part of the reason why newspapers or news organizations in general are looking for experienced White House correspondents, because you live or die by your sources and your ability to work with speed. And not all journalists are created equal when it comes to either putting a story together, writing a story, or getting it in on deadline, getting it edited, getting it into the newspaper, that kind of thing. So it just depends on the medium and, I would say, the correspondents themselves, what kind of sources or sourcing they have, the editing that goes into it. Does that help you? Does that answer it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Question?
Since 9/11, have you or your colleagues felt a greater pressure to censor yourselves in terms of criticism of the Bush administration, or and do you see a significant difference in journalism before and after 9/11?
Well, that's a very interesting question. What do you think?
Yes.
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 You think there's a big difference between right after 9/11 and now?
Well, right after, certainly, but now I'm not as much.
So you thought that maybe the media had gone too far to the patriotic salute the president side right after 9/11, and the pendulum has swung back now, right? Yes?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I think. I agree. I think that what happens with the media for a multiplicity of reasons is that because of the things I was talking about the media being in business, and also because of the difficulty of being able to source information and to make sure that you're getting a broad enough spectrum of sourcing for your stories, the media at large, mainstream media, can be very sensitive to public sentiment, to a person's political power and clout, to a kind of a nationalistic pride. Not a partisan necessarily, but a definitely a sense of observation of what's in the interest, the better interests of the nation. Especially if a president is trying to say that for reasons that we're not allowed to know, certain things would harm the country. There's a long history of the media being very deferential to presidents in circumstances like that. So I would agree, but my argument is that does not mean your concern or your observation does not mean to me that the media did not do an adequate job of writing about what led up to 9/11 or what happened after 9/11. And why I say that is because you can find the stories in the mainstream press about worries that there was no connection between Al-Qaeda, for instance, and Saddam Hussein, or that there were no weapons of mass destruction. You can find those stories, and they were done. But what you're observing is that there were far many more stories that took as their sourcing international officials, governments, previous administrations, the whole entire Congress in terms of a majority vote for the resolution in 2002 that said that they had seen intelligence information or had information from intelligence sources that supported the president's drive or his perspective about Al-Qaeda. So I would say that it did not take very long for the pendulum to swing back if it had been a little more too hesitant in the beginning to just do the basic things that the mainstream media do, which is to ask questions. Martha comes to the White House briefings almost every day, and she has seen many, many press secretaries come and go. And I think that, you know, at least my observation is that what happens at the White House is that there's just an endless series of questions, and that eventually administrations find it more difficult to not come up with answers that make sense if they keep trying to pursue an avenue of answers that don't line up with the facts.
Yeah.
I think inevitably the pendulum swings the other way.
Well, let me ask you about that. Is if a factor here is reporters don't do things on their own hook, that that you need people saying things. There have to be critics out there.
Right.
And after 9/11, you know, there were no people who were providing the kind of information that say today that they are, the critics that are out there. So in a sense, what
there were. I mean, the weapons inspectors, or even Saddam Hussein himself, who sat down and did an interview with Dan Rather of 60 Minutes, said, we got rid of all the weapons, but nobody wanted to believe him, and the administration couldn't figure out why Saddam Hussein would want to have gotten rid of his weapons and then make it seem like he still had them. Well, there was a good reason why he might want to do that, because he was afraid of being attacked by his neighbors. But at any rate, there were sources, but it is very hard for the media. What Martha's trying to say is the mainstream media have a limited ability to prove a negative, and we do not have subpoena power, and we are not the opposition party, which is something that comes up again and again and again. So what we do is we're trying not to invent events or create the news in the mainstream media. What we're trying to do is cover events and write about the facts as people are willing to describe them or put out intelligence or discuss it or whatever. So I think my only argument is, however much you want to criticize or be concerned about the media being too gullible or swayed by political pressure in the beginning, my argument is that it didn't last that long, and in the grand scheme of things. And what I hope is that we continue to have as broad a spectrum of mainstream media to continue doing a good job of figuring out what events are showing us will be happening now or in the future, and the same spectrum of questions.
Right.
Should we get out? Should we stay? Where is Al-Qaeda? Is it stronger? Is it weaker? Is terrorism really a global issue? Is it something that is a criminal law enforcement issue? Is it really a war? I mean, all those are more pertinent questions to me now than to look too much backwards. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Another? Some more questions there?
I got one. Can you define what you mean by advocacy journalism? Because I guess my standard, I would think the New York Times would be more of an advocacy journalism for their point of view. Can you just define what you think advocacy journalism means?
Advocacy journalism to me means a news organ, and I'll give you an example. Like National Review has a editorial point of view that supports its entire existence. It is a conservative magazine that exists to promote, discuss, and report on a conservative spectrum of policies and ideas, and then of course to analyze and critique a more liberal democratic spectrum of policies and ideas. That to me is an advocacy magazine. And why I bring that up is because I write for a magazine that people confuse with National Review. It's called National Journal, and it's nonpartisan, and it's also weekly, but we do have columnists who will express a point of view based on their reporting or analysis, but not necessarily a reliable spectrum of political points of view, like Democrat, Independent, or Republican. And what we try to do is a depth of reporting a National Journal that is informed by facts and is trying to incorporate a variety of points of views and report them to the audience and let them make up their mind. Now, what I want to challenge you on is you may feel that the New York Times has an editorial meaning on the main pages of the paper, a perspective that is more liberal than conservative. What I think, though, is that the New York Times, I don't consider that an advocacy newspaper, but they have an editorial page that has a strong advocacy point of view on many important issues that I would say is probably more left of center. So I would disagree on that in terms of my definition. We tend to think of Fox News, Fox News Network, as being more disposed to a conservative or Republican point of view. And in fact, the creators of Fox News said that it was invented as a counter to CNN, which during the Clinton years was jokingly referred to as the Clinton News Network, meaning that there were lots of audience members who thought that the disposition of CNN was much more left of center than it was or right of center. So even in the spectrum of things we think of as mainstream, there's still orientations that you can sort of detect. What would you say about the Washington Times? Washington Times is a newspaper that is very disposed to a conservative range of reporting. They're still reporting on the events of the day, but the assemblage of facts and the outlook can oftentimes, not in all stories, but can oftentimes be very disposed to a conservative or Republican point of view. The Nation, there's a magazine very left of center. Advocacy is very much for liberal perspectives. I'm just curious, is there anybody in the class who has served in Iraq or Afghanistan?
Yeah.
Yes? Can you introduce yourself and say where you served?
My name is Sabine.
I'm sorry, what?
Babylon.
And with what branch of the military?
Marine Corps.
And how long ago did you serve?
I was there in spring 2003 in the invasion.
Ooh. And what would you say about advocacy media? Do you, when you read and listen to news, do you think that there's a point of view?
Absolutely.
And what do you think it is?
I think pretty much 90% of all media is biased against the military.
Against the military?
And the war.
And is there anybody else there in the class who has a family member or a friend serving? Yes? Did I see a hand? Yes? Do you have, can you say who is serving and where?
I have no idea, but I know he was my friend. He is a photographer or something like that. And he went, like, during the summer of last year.
In the Army? In the Army?
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
And you don't know where he is now?
No.
Okay. Anybody else? Yes?
Yeah, I was in the Air Force, so I had several friends who were in Afghanistan and Iraq.
And do you talk to them still about have you ever talked to them about media coverage?
Yeah, I talked to my friend who was in the invasion, and he felt pretty much like the other guy here, that it was pretty biased against them.
What about the embeds program? Because, you know, there were journalists. There was a reporter from National Journal, for example, who was embedded with
We had three journalists from my company who were embedded during the invasion, and one of them was killed. Michael Kelly was killed in the drive to Baghdad, and then we had two others who were embedded, and both returned home.
And generally, the program was regarded as one that was very favorable to the military. And you all didn't find it so?
I think it's a bad idea because it puts journalists in harm's way and it makes the combat units they're attached to less effective. So it more or less takes more troops to protect the journalists, and they're not able to do their actual job. So basically, the unit that they're with becomes less effective when they're in the field. So they're more susceptible to being killed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, it's interesting because there's a big debate about that, that's for sure. Definitely.
What about the, you say that they're biased against the military. In what way? Is it in terms of the amount of coverage? Is it the type of things that are covered?
Well, I don't really want to get too far into it, but I mean, what it comes back down to is money. People that watch TV, they want to see shock and awe. They don't want to hear about how people are handing out, you know, stuffed animals and snacks to little Iraqi kids. They want to see people getting blown to bits and, you know, chunks of bodies flying across the street. So, I mean, I really, when I turn on the news, I don't expect to see the good stories about, you know, all the diseases getting cured and everybody getting vaccinated and hospitals reopened and everything. I just expect to hear about car bombs and people getting killed.
Is there any chance that you would be called back?
I'm going back voluntarily.
When are you going back?
Probably in the summer.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah. I was just curious. There's no point to my questions. I'm just playing reporter. That's the natural instinct.
Some more questions?
How many people have been to the White House? So you're going to go again, right? And you're going to see Tony Snow?
Hopefully. We'll see.
Yeah?
Yeah. I really haven't told
them. Oh, you haven't told them. I'm sorry. That was called a leak. That was a leak. An unauthorized leak. Sorry. Oops. Well, I guess you're looking forward to it, aren't you?
They're going to be, I think as the plans that I'm currently working on is to have you come in for a briefing at the White House, at the press center, one of the press secretary's briefings, and then afterwards he's going to talk to you all. That sound good?
Field trip, yay. you can see the little tiny, not very good quarters that we work in, and you can see, you know, reporters looking like, you know, they're trying to find their way just like everybody else and beating up on poor Tony Snow, ha, ha, ha. So it's actually a good, I'm just interested because it's a fun thing for you guys to do and a good chance to see something different than just, you know, the books.
Yeah. Anything else?
When interviewing an individual, how important is it to consider their personality and style when you're trying to get information out of them that they're somewhat hesitant to release?
That's a really good question because it kind of goes to the techniques that, you know, reporters use to try to pry information out of people. You're talking about somebody who may not want to give up some information, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think all reporters have different personality techniques, how they read someone or they try to understand the hesitation that someone might have about giving up information. But one of the things that I try to use truly is trust and honesty. I'm trying to give them an idea of what it is that I'm doing, why I'm writing the story. I really don't fool people into thinking the story is going to go in one direction and then play gotcha and go in a different direction, because you never build trust by doing that. You want them to understand what direction you're going and let it be their choice and not be surprised at the end. That doesn't mean that I tell them what my story is going to be or what direction, but I try to ask them to help me understand something better and try to build in them a recognition that I'm trying to pull together as complete a set of facts. But let me give an example. Sometimes I talk to people in Washington, and this will not shock you, who don't want to tell you the straight information, and we call it spinning. You've heard that phrase? So So the idea is that I'm talking to officials who are very accomplished, practiced at spinning, meaning that they're trying to encourage me to see things their way without giving me a full sense of the facts. So sometimes you have to be very brassy and insistent with those people to let them know that you know that that's like half the story or a quarter of the story, and you're not going to be fooled. Let's see the whole story. But sometimes you also interview people who are not as practiced at being interviewed, and you can be much more persuasive by not being combative and being very straight up with them. I don't know how many people were paying attention to the news during the Libby trial, but did anybody listen or hear on the news the tape of Bob Woodward interviewing Dick Armitage from the State Department or see the transcript? Well, that was a very interesting, those are two people who knew each other well and had talked many times over the years. And Woodward adopted a level of discussion, a kind of phraseology and a way of having a conversation with Armitage that was very much all male, buddy to buddy, very conversational, very like, you know, trust me, I trust you. And that was very interesting because oftentimes the interviews that I have are much more like a conversation than you see on television where like Russert is interrogating someone. That's a form of an interview, but it's not a conversation really. So there are lots of different forms that interviewing takes.
One last question.
Well, thank you guys very much.
Yeah, thank you, Alexis.
Thanks, it was
appreciate
fun.
It.
And
yeah.
And give the media more of a chance. Cut us some slack. We try, but we're learning from you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.